I'm 10 and I'm an alcoholic. And how I did it was with the help of a lot of you and a lot of other people who aren't even here today. And that's how I did it. I was telling somebody, I was watching the folks in line to get food, and all I could think about was the amount of people that played a role at one time or another in helping me get sober. And for that, you know, there isn't enough gratitude. People put up with a lot of shit when I got here. I want to thank Jim and Carol for opening their home and putting on this deal. I sponsored Jim, and Carol sponsors him too. So he gets a lot of sponsorship. And, I have a feeling right now, it's like a kid coming down the stairs on Christmas morning and looking under the tree and seeing all you folks, realizing I got every gift I could ever ask for. You know, just thank you for being here. When I got sober, it was July of 1970 in a little town called Brooklyn. And they knew right away I was a newcomer because I showed up for my first meeting on the 5th of July, wearing a blue wool suit. And I had on tie and nice shoes. And at the door, the guys were in shorts, and the greeter said, "Welcome, newcomer." And I thought, wow, these guys are really intuitive, you know? And the deal was, I went into the meeting, and there were a couple of guys inside the door, and they said, "If you want the miracle to happen, you have to go up front." And I sure wanted the miracle. I was so thrilled to be an AA. And so I said, "Oh, thank you." And my wife and children had moved out of state to try to maintain their sanity. I had some trouble with the police because I had a habit of finding things before people officially lost them. And I was sleeping on my mother's couch, and she lived in a senior place. So I guess the winning streak maybe was winding down, you know? And after the meeting, these five guys said, let's go have coffee. And so I didn't have anything heavy on my calendar except to go home to the couch. And so I said, sure. So we went to a little diner, and there were two plumbers, a guy who worked in the DA's office, a priest, and a guy who worked for the FBI. And I thought, wow, I've really fallen. I mean, hanging out with these guys. One of the plumbers said to me, "I'm going to be your temporary sponsor." And I said, "Okay." And he was my temporary sponsor for 34 years. And he was a human being that you had to see to appreciate. He had been a fighter when he was younger, and he never won a round. He had a face and a head that looked like it had already worn out two bodies. And he had this uncontrollable twitch. So it was really hard to talk eye to eye with him. And over a period of time, people began to notice I was picking something up from him. And the deal was, he had me over his house every night, came and got me and brought me over his house. And he said, "I think it's important that you eat here with us and go to a meeting every night." And he had a home. It wasn't a house, it was a home. They didn't have a formal dining room, table. They had a picnic table with benches on either side because they never knew who was going to show up. And he sat at one end and his wife sat at the other end. And you could just feel the love in that home, the way they interacted and the way they treated each other. It was amazing. And after 2 or 3 weeks, I wish I had a different story here. After 2 or 3 weeks one night, I was always, most of you are too young to remember 1970, but it was the first time they introduced a nine-passenger station wagon. And Fast Eddie and I always had to sit in the back, and that seat faced out. And I used to ask him, why do we have to sit there? And he would say, I want you to see the wreckage of your past. And so this one night, the phone rings, and he gets off the phone, and he's really excited. That head was swiveling all over the place. And he said to me, Kenny, we got a 12-step call. I said, good, I have no idea what the hell a 12-step call was. He said, we got to go pick this guy up and take him to a meeting. So we run out to the car, and I head around to the back, and he said, no, come sit up front. I thought, wow, I've only been here 3 weeks, and I moved from looking out the back to seeing what we're going to hit, you know? So I got in the front, and it was a typical brownstone in Brooklyn, no parking. So we stopped, and he said, do you think you can go get this guy? And I said, I'm an alcoholic. I'm not illiterate. So he said, go get this guy, Kenny, and bring him out, and we're going to take him to a meeting, and we're going to give him a shot at sobriety, and I'm going to ride around the block, and then I'll come back and get you. So as he tells the story, he rode around the block, and when he came back, I have the guy on the ground, and I'm beating him with a garbage can lid. Sometime between the guy calling and us getting there, he had what was called a change of heart. And I found out later he was entitled to that. But at the time, I didn't know that. I just know I told my sponsor I'd get him and get him out to the curb. So I hit him maybe 5, 6, 7, no more than 8 times. But after the 3rd shot, if you had seen him, he was willing to turn his life over to me. I mean, he was ready to surrender. And my sponsor whistled to me like I was a canine. And I got back in the car, and man, we were between his swiveling and my swiveling. And we started down the avenue. And he said, I want you to do me 2 favors. And I said, what's that? He said, first, don't ever consider that a 12-step. And he said, second, don't tell anybody I'm your sponsor for it. He said, let's see how this thing goes, you know. And that was my introduction to AA. And it's amazing. You make one little mistake in AA, and it kind of spreads. It's like a community virus, you know. You go to meetings, and I'm just getting a cup of coffee. Shortly after that, I had an incident, I won't go into it, but involved a tire iron. But I was pretty popular. They said, don't ever take Ken on a 12-step call. You know, unless you have enough guys to take the person to a meeting and post bail. You know? And I got off to that kind of a start. And I went to a lot of meetings at that time. And when we went into a meeting, we didn't have the 12 steps or the traditions hanging up. there was a blackboard, and on that blackboard, it had the four things you needed to do to stay sober. And those four things were show up, pay attention, tell the truth, and don't be attached to the results. And if you did those four things, you were sober. And then they had some guy would come over, usually somebody with no teeth, no hair, and say something like, are you here to surrender, or is this just a ceasefire? Because if it's a ceasefire, you're wasting your time. You got to come here to surrender. And then they'd ask you, do you know the difference between you and God? And of course, you know, you stand there looking stupid. And they say, the difference between you and God is God never pretends to be you. You know? So it was a very informative group. You picked up a lot of stuff quickly, you know. And they used to tell the newcomer, you know, a real alcoholic, a new real alcoholic is someone who finds something that works and then they stop doing it. So come here, get involved, and do what you're supposed to do. And that was my kickoff into Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the guys, maybe the fifth or sixth meeting I was at, he was a guy who I used to call them stoop philosophers, you know. He had more scars on him than a mannequin, you know. And he came over to me one day, and I was getting coffee. And they used to have a way of just rubbing up against you sideways. And new kid, right? Yeah, I'm a new kid. He said, just remember this. Be what you is and not what you ain't. Because if you is what you ain't, you ain't what you is. And I'm thinking, what did I do? You know, what did I do to you, Lord? I mean, you know, I said, oh, thanks. That's valuable information. I'm going to put it right here by my heart, you know. But those are the kind of guys you met along the way who got you sober. And when they gave you the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of those guys were involved in writing it. You have to remember that in 1970, Bill Wilson was still alive. I was going to the meetings he used to go to, but he wasn't going to them because although he was able to stop drinking, he was never able to stop smoking. So he had severe emphysema. So he didn't come to the meetings. In fact, my sobriety date, July 5th of 1970, was the very last public talk that Bill Wilson gave. And he gave it in Miami at the International Convention on Sunday morning. And while he was saying his last talk, I was at my first meeting. You know? And the deal was is that when they handed you the book, they used to tell you, this book is the equivalent of handing you a key to get out of jail. But you have to use the key. We can't open the cell. And you open the cell by doing what's in this book. And as someone told me recently, if you look in the big book, there are no pictures. Pretty clever. However, on every page in that big book is a mirror. And the more you follow the suggestions of that book and that page, and the more you try to do those actions to change, that mirror begins to let you see more and more of who you really are. And that's the way you go through the book. And, you know, it doesn't matter how someone looks when they first came in, whether they're wearing a wool suit or beat up or whatever the deal is, they get the same respect as everyone else. You know, a joke that was told early on in my sobriety was about a guy who showed up at the house of ill repute, and he had no arms and he had no legs. And the madam looked down on him very disdainfully, and she said, "Just what the hell you think you're going to do here?" And he looked up at her and he said, "I rang the bell, didn't I?" So regardless of how someone looks, they could be a bell ringer, you know? It doesn't really matter. And the deal is that when we would do meetings, you never spoke at your own meeting. And there were never topic meetings. The way we did it is we went into New York to a booking agent deal, and there were blackboards up there. And you had every group's home group on that blackboard with a date. If they met on Friday, it would be every Friday date for 3 months. And you would say that your group would take that commitment and write your name in there. And then you'd go back, and that blackboard that we had up front with the four propositions on it, on the other side, you'd fill in the commitments you were going to take. So every meeting was a speaker's meeting, but you never heard the speakers from your group. You always heard them coming in from another group. And the deal there is that you'd hear stories from all different kinds of guys. And you'd hear certain guys who, let's say, taught at Columbia and Fordham, and they were always more articulate about how they drank and what they did. And then you'd hear guys from the Bowery who had a whole different story. And one of the things that I always thought was challenging in AA, and I still hear it today, is people talk about meaning. What's the meaning of life? Why am I here? What's the meaning? And I'm going to relax you with a very simple answer. Life has no meaning. There's absolutely no meaning. But you and me, we have meaning. And that's the meaning that we bring to life. So the question is irrelevant because we're the answer. And the simplicity of that is that you don't have to be looking for anything. You already have it. You just have to go inside and find it out. And I've read things over the years from people that really interest me. Emmett Fox wrote a lot about acceptance. He also quoted Psalm 46:10 almost all the time. And Psalm 46:10 says, "Be still and know that I am God." For an alcoholic to be still is a death-defying act. There's always something to be screwed up, you know. Another definition of an alcoholic is frequently wrong, but never in doubt. Never in doubt. And so the reality here of the 46th Psalm is, I looked at it over. In fact, I have it as a bookmarker in my book, and I see it every day. And one day it hit me, because I love to do numbers. And I counted the letters in "Be still and know that I am God." And there's 24. So I assume that's the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. And if you add up the numbers 4, 6, and 1, you get 11, which is our spiritually awakening step. So that reading began to mean more and more to me, because I felt there was some really special significance to it. And the deal I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous is there are a lot of people who come into Alcoholics Anonymous who think that it's a crash course in running and reaping rewards. And that's not the deal. The deal is, this is a new way of living, and you learn to do it on a daily basis. every day you learn to show up and do the best you can for that day. And hanging out with the guys I did was a hoot, you know, just a hoot, because I grew up in a neighborhood where most of us got through school totally unscarred by education, you know. We actually had guys who you'd say, there's a dead bird, and they all look up, you know. And they were just not particularly bright. In the fourth grade, the teacher asked my buddy, Vinny, how do you spell Mississippi? And Vinny looked back at her and said, you mean the river or the state, you know? Those are the kind of guys, you know. I've been part of conversations where I heard somebody say, you know, Nikki, if your mother didn't have any children, there's a good chance you won't. So when you're getting your collective conscious from those guys, you come up short a little bit. You find out that a lot of times people are very, very sure they know the right answer when they really didn't even know the question. And so in Alcoholics Anonymous, I found that you'll kind of drift towards people who are doing the deal the way you think it's best to be done. But that doesn't mean there's only one way. You know, as the old timers used to say, there's lots of ways to make change for a dollar. You can do 4 quarters, you can do 20 nickels, you can do 10 dimes, you can do 100 pennies, or you can do any combination. And when you're done, you still have a dollar. And so I like that part. I like the fact that we are equal, but not the same. And we're a fellowship where our unity is based on our diversity. Anybody can come through the door. That's one of the great things that Bill Wilson did. Like a lot of human beings, he had his frailties. But the one great thing he did for Alcoholics Anonymous is he kept the door wide open so as many people could come through it. In 1955, when they were coming out with the second edition of the Big Book, he opened it up to the Buddhist, the Jainist, and Judaism. And he took a lot of heat because people said, well, they're going to water it down and they're going to do this. That's another thing in AA. If you want to get in trouble, do something. It doesn't matter what you do, just do something. And there'll always be a group that, well, that's it. That's the end of the program. You know, anyone might as well close up the doors now, Larry. You know, it's all over. Look what they're doing with this thing. I mean, and the deal is when the more and more people who can get through that door, and that's what Bill Wilson said. He said, I want this program to be so wide open that we never deny anyone looking for sobriety a chance to find it. And that's the way it comes in. And I learned a lot about love here. I didn't know a whole lot about love when I got here. And I don't think most alcoholics do. We know about lust, but I don't know if we know a whole lot about love. And some of the things I learned an acronym for love several years ago. And I think it's something that helps me every day. And it's L-O-V-E. And the L in love stands for listen. If you're involved with someone you say you love, you owe them the respect to listen whenever they're saying something. It doesn't mean you have to agree with them, but listening is the key. And then O stands for overlook. Learn to overlook their weak points and focus on what they do well and bring it to their attention. I don't know how you get so much done, or you're an amazing lady or a guy or whatever, but overlook the soft points and focus on the good points. And then the V is value. You know, you give value to my life. Because I wake up in the morning and you're here, my life is better. Every day I'm with you, my life is enhanced. You know, you make me a more valuable person to myself, And when I'm with you, I want to be on my best behavior. And the last one is E, and that's encourage. When someone says, I think I'd like to try this, don't come up with 30 reasons why they shouldn't. Come up with reasons why they should. If anyone can do this, you could. You have all the skill set necessary to do this. And encourage them to get out there and go do it. And then when you learn to love somebody, and they love you, something happens. And what happens, in my experience, is when somebody really loves you, it strengthens you. It makes you stronger as a human being. And when you really love somebody else, it gives you courage. It gives you a lot of courage. Take whatever risk I need to take. Do whatever I have to do to make this work. Because this is the person I love. And that love, if you carry that into every relationship, you find out people start to react differently. It may not happen right away, but over time it happens. People will see you coming, and instead of figuring out ways to get away, they'll be figuring out ways how they can spend time with you. And that those are the things, the basic things that happen. When I look out at you guys, and I could probably go to each person, there's a few new people I met today, but I would say about 90% of the people here I know by name, and I could tell you something you said or did that helped me at a given point in time. And that's how we sustain each other. It's not a case of giving in. AA is not about giving in. AA is about letting in, letting people come in. This is who I am. However you see me, this is the best I can be today. And not get into all the bullshit that goes on. You know, I love people in AA who are working on humility. You know, they go to a wedding, they want to be the bride. They go to a funeral, they want to be the corpse. And they want to do it humbly. I don't need a lot of attention. Just give me the flowers, you know. And that's just the way it is here. You go to enough meetings and you're going to hear all kinds of things. You know, alcoholics seem to have certain traits. One of those traits is, if you're a non-alcoholic, you change your habits to meet your goals. But if you're an alcoholic, you change your goals to meet your habits. You know what I'm saying? You know, you lower everything because you don't want to have too much pressure on you. There's drinking to be done. You know, I used to have two older brothers and four older sisters. And three of those sisters died from alcohol. And my one brother died from alcohol. And I had a brother and sister die a week apart. My sister died Christmas Day of 85, and my brother died New Year's Day of 86. And I couldn't understand the damage they had done to my mom at the time until I lost my own son. But the reality is that we're walking around most of the time before we get here with a disease we don't know we have. But everybody who loves us and interacts with us, they've got the symptoms. You know, little kids say things like, you know, if daddy's the drunk, how come mommy acts so crazy? You know, and the deal is we don't even see the impact we have on the people around us. And I just remember in my house, my mom said, you know, the only time you kids say no to a drink is if you misunderstood the question. You know? And my dad was dead at 50. And I got to see my dad scribble around on the floor and die. And that's when I knew adults lied. Because I remember people telling me, the guy who came from the mortuary said, he died peacefully. I'm thinking, I don't know where you were at. But he was kicking cabinets and doing everything he could to stay. And it didn't go a minute. It went 4 or 5 minutes. And the deal is you just become aware of the fact that this is just part of your heritage. I had a lot of fun in the beginning drinking. I started drinking about 12, and I don't mean going out and getting shit-faced drinking. My brother was a bartender, and so on the way home from school, I'd stop at the bar, I'd go in the back, the guys would be, there was a pool table in the back, and they'd be playing pinochle and poker, and I like pinochle, so I'd sit down, and they had pitcher beer, I'd have a couple of beers, play some pinochle, and go home. I'm not the guy who took my first drink and went, "Ooh, it's going to change my life." I took it and went home and didn't even have any impact on me. But I was in training to become a real hemorrhoid, you know. And the deal was that it just kept moving forward more and more. And I can remember my brother Gene, who was 12 years older than me, one night we were shooting darts, and the more he drank, the more mechanical he became in shooting darts. He'd be better and better. And so we'd be drinking free and free. I, on the other hand, the more I drank, my darts took on a flight of their own. I mean, I had no idea where they were going to end up. You know, I just... And this one night, I remember throwing a dart, and it did a little up in the air, and there was a bathroom there with a brake front, and the guy was going in, and there was a break in the bottom of the brake front, and the dart went in his leg. And my brother looked at me and said, "We're going to need that dart." So I followed the guy into the commode, and he was standing at the urinal, and I just said, "Excuse me," and I went down and I pulled it out of his leg, and he said, "Thanks." You know, life has a way of taking care of itself. You know, that's just the way it is. I've been fortunate enough in my sobriety to meet a lot of nice people. I got bailed out of a jam when I was newly sober that could have put me away for a while. And the grand jury said something bad about me. And I had to go and see a district attorney. And in Brooklyn, there were about 300 district attorneys at the courthouse. And the guy I drew was the guy I met in the diner the first night. And when I went in, he said, "I didn't know you did this shit." And I said, "I didn't know you did this shit." And he said to me, "I'm going to get the officer who's handling this and see if we can work something out." So we brought in a sergeant detective who was handling it out of all the cops in New York. And he's the guy I played football with in high school. And he looked at this and he said, "If you plead guilty, I'll do anything to help you. But if you say you're not, I'm going to turn this over to someone else because I don't want to be the guy who closes the door on you." And I said, "No, I didn't do it." And he started for the door. And I had one of those moments of, I couldn't keep my mouth shut. And I said, "Hold on." I said, I did do this. And he came back. And he co-signed a note for me to cover the deal, the money involved. And I signed a note with the bank, and every month for 18 years I paid on that note. How does that happen? Out of all the DAs, how does that happen? Out of all the 25,000 cops in New York, how does that happen? But it did. Tonight, a young lady was introduced to me, and she's 45 days sober. And there were three women here who her mom sponsored. And so they got with her. And the deal is, how does that happen? Her mom did so much for all three of them. And now here's her daughter, 40, you know. These things just seem to happen. And there's no explanation. the more you try to explain a spiritual experience, you lose it. Because it's not meant for words. It's meant for feelings. And that's why we do the language of the heart here. The heart is the thing here. It's not about logic. I mean, if this were a logical world, men would ride side saddle. Think of John Wayne on a horse going, "Hey, pilgrim," you know. The deal is that this whole world is totally illogical. You know, Blaise Pascal says the only reason we have reason is so that human beings will know that there are things beyond it. And that's just the way it is. You can't explain half the stuff that happens. I wanted to commit suicide here in the gun jam. I jumped in front of a car and the car changed lane. I mean, you know, you go to meetings and you hear stories, and even if they're tainted, they're still unbelievable. You can't figure them out. I knew I was home free in a lot of areas about 8 years ago. I was riding through El Cajon. It was a hot day. And this Rottweiler was chasing cars. And, you know, that's like a Doberman on speed, you know. And he ran after my little car, and I saw him, and I pulled over. And he caught up with me, and I rolled down the window. And I looked at him, and I just posed a simple question. What now? You know, what now? You know? He looked at me, and I looked at him, and just for that moment, he knew that I knew that he was chasing after shit he didn't know what to do with. And I knew that he knew I had done the same thing. And just for a minute, we were locked. And then I said, "Hang in there, maybe you can catch a Volkswagen." And I rolled up the window and pulled away. Now, there are people who may find that a little strange. But to me, that's the way life works. You do what you feel is necessary in the moment. And don't worry about so many results. I lived a good part of my life, with my mind being held hostage by the past and by the future. And subsequently, I was never in the now. I was never in the moment. I was always looking back, looking forward, you know, but not really understanding what this now was all about. But, you know, in 2002, I hit the lotto. I met a woman, and we had known each other before, and for the first time, she was unattached, and I was unattached, and we just got together. I didn't know that love could be that good. I didn't know that life could offer so much to a bozo like me. And every day, in every way, I wanted to be the best I could be. And we never started sentences with, "This would be better," or "You would be better if," or the best dialogue we had in our relationship was what we didn't say. It wasn't necessary to say. You know, when you see somebody do something that you can poke fun at or be sarcastic or whatever word you want to use, but letting that dialogue go, not necessary. And always finding the good of it. And realizing that, hey, this is a gift. And it's a gift that I had never experienced before at that depth. And we had laughter and we had love. And then on Father's Day in 2016, she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And about 4 months later, she was gone. And I think of the 4 months we spent together. We changed the game rules of our relationship. We sat down and we said, you know, whatever you want to try, whatever you want to do, I'll help you. And if you change your mind on what you want to do, just tell me and we'll change. You don't have to explain anything. And this is the new rules of us. And we did that. And it reached a point where on Thursday night, on the 10th of November, 2016, she went to bed, and during the night, about 3:30 in the morning, she was in tremendous pain, and I helped her out of bed and took her to the bathroom and sat her down and then left so she'd have some privacy. And then I could hear her cry. So I went in and kissed her on the head and took her hand and held it and kissed her on the shoulder. And then she looked up at me with that beautiful smile of hers and those green eyes. And she said, "If you think you're getting a taste tonight, mister, you're mistaken." And the two of us started to laugh so hard at 4 o'clock in the morning when there was absolutely nothing to laugh at. Absolutely nothing. And that's what we did. And then I helped her back into bed. Friday she went into a coma. Saturday she was dead. So our last words were not words. Our last words were laughter. Just laughter. And realizing that we had both, I realized I had lucked out, and she always said she had lucked out. And when you experience that, and you have sobriety, and you have the support of you people, there's no way you can lose. You know, there's a lot of people say, "He's a loser," or "She's a loser." There's no losers in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a lot of slow winners. But there are no losers. You know, that's just the way it is. And the reality of this is that I can't tell you the gratitude and the love I feel for you guys showing up today, and Jim and Carol making their home available, and seeing all you folks collectively. This is like a dream. It's so wonderful. And I thank each and every one of you for putting up with me. As my mother said, drunk or sober, you are no day at the beach. And when I told her I was not drinking and I had a sobriety date, and she said, "What's yours?" And I said, "July 5th. And she gave me a big hug and a kiss. And she said, "That makes it easy. You did everything on a 5th. You know, I'll just be able to do that." So again, thank you all from the bottom of my heart. And I'm going to say a little thing that I heard from a Sufi guy. And it goes like this. You cannot catch hold of it, nor can you let go of it. In not being able to get it, you get it. When you are speaking, it's silent. When you are silent, it speaks. God bless you. Thank you.